Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The CDC reports that nearly 99% of sexually active women have used some form of birth control, and most have had to pay out of pocket for it. But new recommendations from the Institute of Medicine could change that. As part of a list of preventive health care services, the group recommends eliminating co-pays for contraceptives. Joining me in the studio to talk about the recommendations, Julie Waxman of the National Women's Law Center, Julie Robner of NPR, Helen Alvarez of George Mason University, and joining us by phone, Dr. Linda Rosenstock. She's chair of the IOM committee that released the recommendations. But before we begin our discussion, we're going to hear first from U.S. Senator Barbara Mikulski of Maryland. Good morning to you, Senator.
This is really big news.
Barbara Mikulski. Are you there?
Barbara Mikulski's here. Good morning, Diane.
Good morning. It's so good to have you with us.
Diane, I'm excited to be here and very excited about this Institute of Medicine's series of recommendations on women's health preventive services. Aegis was an amendment that I offered during the health care debate.
Yes.
And it requires, we wanted learned society to advise us on what we needed to have as a comprehensive women's health care prevention benefit. And their recommendations have now come out, and it will be very important to shifting prevent from men going only to acute care to preventive care.
Tell me why you felt so strongly about this and why you felt it was so important to add this.
Well, Diane, during the entire health care debate and the hearings, it was very clear that what I found in our hearings was that just being a woman was treated as a pre-existing condition. We were charged more and got less services for men of equal age and health care status. That often we were penalized because of being a woman. And then they tried to take our mammograms away from us. And I said no. And we offered an amendment on the floor that passed with over 70 votes, including support from great guys in the United States Senate. And it said it instructed the Department of Health and Human Services to turn to a learned society to come up with a series of recommendations that would recognize women's unique health situation at all stages of their life.
So now, are the recommendations from the Institute of Medicine those that you envisioned?
Yes, I did. What I envisioned was that the Institute of Medicine would turn and look at conditions that affected a broad population of women, that the condition to be prevented had a large potential impact on their health and well-being, but that it would be very strongly evidence-based and not ideologically based.
So how significant do you think these recommendations will be to women's health generally?
Well, I think it'll be just fantastic. First of all, we eliminate co-pays and deductibles. It changes it also to prevention. It says that women will be able to get an annual visit to do like a health care audit on what their situation is, from everything from diabetes to menopause. And for younger women, it will also offer other services related to childbearing or family planning. So it's going to have a very important impact where, first of all, being treated as a woman will be recognized for her unique health needs. Second, she will have access to those services that screen for those things that could disadvantage her immediately or would have long-range consequences. It changes the nature of health care. It gives women an opportunity to be treated seriously by both their doctors and by their insurance companies.
U.S. Senator Barbara Mikulski of Maryland, thanks for joining us.
Okay, Diane, and we'll talk soon.
Good to talk with you. Thank you. And now turning to you, Julie Robner, these are simply recommendations from the Institute of Medicine, the Department of Health and Human Services. Secretary Sebelius has not come out with final recommendations. Is that so?
That's correct. Now, there were in the law, it specified that there were some preventive services that would be automatically covered without cost sharing, without copays or deductibles. Those were the certain services that were recommended by the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, vaccines that were recommended by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and certain services for children and adolescents. Lessons recommended by the American Academy of Pediatrics. Then there were these women's health services as were put forth by Senator Mikulski and that were sent out for recommendation to the Institute of Medicine. Now it is up, as you say, to the Secretary of Health and Human Services. There's every expectation that she will endorse these, and that's actually expected in the very near term, within the next couple of weeks.
And turning to you, Dr. Linda Rosenstock, you are chair of the Institute of Medicine's Committee for Preventive Services for Women. You're also Dean of the School of Public Health at the University of California, Los Angeles. I gather this is not really free birth control for everyone. Explain.
Absolutely, and good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
I think there's been some misimpression. I think when it comes to, we actually recommended 8 additional screenings or services, and Senator Mikulski has already identified some of those. One that's gotten a lot of attention is the family planning services. But what people need to understand is that we're giving guidance to the department to consider whether health insurers should need to provide these services in terms of no co-payments, no deductibles, what we might call first dollar coverage. Indeed, most of health insurance plans and many federal plans and state plans already require the provision of family planning services. What we're suggesting is that the evidence that these work very well to avoid the serious problem of unintended pregnancies and to promote optimal birth spacing between children is such that trying to reduce the barriers of co-payments or deductibles should be added.
So you're really talking about more than just birth control. You're talking about counseling for STDs. You're talking about screening for HIV. You're talking about breastfeeding support and counseling, screening for domestic violence, and at least one preventive health exam each year. Is that correct?
That's correct. Those were the 8 listed services. And in context, what we had, and we were very enthusiastic as a committee to be given this opportunity, was that the Affordable Care Act really did focus on prevention for the first time in a major piece of healthcare legislation in the country. And that lets us shift from a system that primarily is reactive to people's acute and urgent needs. We need to be reactive to people's needs. But if we start to consider putting prevention at the forefront, the opportunity is that you're going to avoid long-term health consequences and health costs as well. So there was an existing list of services already covered in the legislation for reasons that we think made much sense. Senator Mikulski said we needed to take a particular lens looking at women's services because women in particular stand to benefit from preventive services. They live longer, they have more chronic disease and disability, they have reproductive gender-specific issues. And for all those reasons, we looked carefully, and we, I think some people expected we come up with even more services, but we felt that the evidence for these eight particular services, from visits to screening for gestational diabetes to counseling and education, including supporting breastfeeding, were all important evidence-based steps to improve women's health.
Dr. Linda Rosenstock, she's chair of the Institute of Medicine's Committee for Preventive Services for Women. Helen Alperet, what is your reaction to this report?
Well, my first reaction, you know, as a woman who's a lawyer, not a doctor, is that it's terrific that they're turning their attention to preventive services for women. It's something that's long needed to be done, and even a layperson to the medicine can understand that. I did have, because of my long research in this area, a negative reaction to the recommendation that contraception, including things that like Ella, FDA-approved morning after pill, that has chemicals that act more like an abortifacient, destroying an embryo after it's created. I was had a problem with that, mostly because over a long study of this issue, one can see there's really undisputed evidence that large-scale government push on birth control as the solution to unintended pregnancy hasn't only failed, but according to the CDC and Guttmacher Institute and the Census Bureau, it is correlated with increases in every problem that it alleges to correct. If you look at the data over the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s to today, increases in attention and funding to this have resulted in more non-marital pregnancies and births, more abortions, more sexually transmitted infections, and all to the great disadvantage of our poorest and minority women.
Helen Alperet, she's professor of law at George Mason University. When we come back, we'll hear from Judy Waxman at the Women's National Women's Law Center. And welcome back. We're talking about new recommendations from the Institute of Medicine that, as part of a list of preventive health services, would eliminate copays for contraceptives. Here in the studio, Julie Robner, she's health policy correspondent for NPR, author of Healthcare Policy and Politics, A through Z, and contributing editor for National Journal Daily. Also, Helen Alperet. She's professor of law at George Mason University. And on the line with us, Dr. Linda Rosenstock, chair of the Institute of Medicine's committee that made these recommendations to the Health and Human Services Department. And turning to you now, Judy Waxman, what is your reaction? You've been pushing for these kinds of recommendations for years. Tell us why.
We have been pushing, as you say. I was asked to testify before the panel, so that's part of the pushing, for these recommendations, for the very reasons that Senator Mikulski stated already, that it was an oversight, if you will, for many years that women's preventive services were not looked at as seriously as others. And it was time, and we thank her for her work on the new Affordable Care Act, in which this provision appears, to commission this independent scientific board that looked at the issue carefully and came up with these 8 recommendations that we believe will be very beneficial to women's health across the nation.
Now, there is some concern about cost and how much cost this could add to the total health care bill. Julie.
Yes. Now, of course, most of these services are already, as Dr. Rosenstock said, most of these services are already covered. It's just a question of making it first dollar coverage. And that's why I think we've all resisted the urge to use that term free. It's really first dollar coverage. So everyone will be paying for it in their premiums rather than paying for it when you go and get it at the point of service. And the idea, of course, is to encourage the use of these services, which this committee has found to be particularly cost effective. But there is a concern for the secretary, not just with these services, but with all of what she's creating, this list of essential services that every insurance policy will have to carry. And the problem with that is that if you load up every package and make it too large, have too many quote-unquote essential services, if the premiums get too big, then people won't be able to afford them. So there is a balancing act here. You want people to have a solid package of insurance to give them what they need, but you don't want those premiums to become so large that they won't be able to afford to have insurance. And that's the balance here. Again, this is the balance with first dollar coverage. Also, you want to spread that risk. You want people to get the services that they need, so you want to encourage them to have these first dollar services, but you don't want to have so many first dollar services that you make the premiums
right
too high.
And Dr. Rosenstock, what about the concerns raised by Helen Alvarez?
I'm going to agree, first of all, about the cost issue and just clarify that
sure.
Our committee was specifically asked not to look at cost, although we all operate in the real world and are sensitive to these issues. And when it comes to family planning services, there's a very robust section in the report about how they've been shown to be very cost effective. I think we have to look at unintended pregnancies through the lens of the reality in America. 50% of all pregnancies in the United States are unintended. That's an extremely high rate. It's the highest, really, in the developed world. Unintended pregnancies carry health risks both for the woman as well as for the newborn. And certainly we have to recognize that they're the driving costs of abortion in this country, although that's an indirect health effect. So our view is that the reason we recommend the full array of FDA-approved services is that with any intervention, there are harms and benefits. And the evidence is the net benefits overwhelm the harms, but then you have to individualize it. And it's up to an individual patient with her physician trying to decide what's the best method to use if she chooses to undertake family planning.
Well, Helen Alvarez, I wonder then if you might agree with the committee that the higher use of contraceptives could help to at least reduce the issue of unintended pregnancies, even in regard to, as you mentioned, the drug Ella.
You know, it seems logical, doesn't it? It's very understandable that especially the public would say, if you take birth control, you don't get pregnant, you don't have a pregnancy. But we don't have to consult theory here. We have decades of numbers. And with increased government attention, and in this I'll refer to government funding of contraception, I mean, our teen pregnancy rate for teens is 250% higher than 1960, 75% higher than 1970. Our out-of-wedlock birth rate is 41%. Our abortions have stalled at 1.2 million. The studies, James Trussell's at Princeton, and dozens of studies, including one just out from Spain in January, England before that, are showing that what happens happens is the market changes. Leading economists, Berkeley, University of Pennsylvania, et cetera, show that when you make birth control the prominent answer, and you've pointed out 99% of people are already have access to it or have used it as sexually active persons, you change the market for sex. The premarital sex in America, Mark Regneris's book, Akerlof, Yellen, and Katz from Berkeley, Click and Stratman from University of Pennsylvania, and George Mason have agreed. Birth control elevation changes the market. It's already a saturated market. Emphasizing it as the answer is likely only to affirm the trivialization of sex and the continuing increase of these numbers. It's undisputed.
Judy Waxman.
I want to repeat something that Julie said, and that is most health plans really do cover contraceptives already. There's a federal law that requires most employers to cover it, and the vast majority of plans do cover. What we have found, and there are many studies to show, that cost is still a barrier.
How much per month?
Well, if someone is lucky enough to have insurance that covers contraceptives, I can use my own daughter as an example. I hope she doesn't kill me for this. But she has a recent college graduate with a great job and her own health insurance, and she pays $25 a month. At her opening salary as a brand new graduate, that's a lot. That is tough for her. Now, she is a responsible person, and she will do that. But you can see where many young women would find even $25 a month as really too much. And what the committee found was that if we could take care of that problem for many women, the chance that they would use contraceptive more consistently, that they would use methods that are more expensive from the outset. Like, for example, an IUD is $600 plus a visit from the outset. That's way too much for many, many women to handle. But if all types of contraceptives are covered and women can get access without the barrier of cost, that could make a very big difference to many women.
Julie Robb.
That was exactly what I was about to say. I think one of the things that bridges what Judy's saying, what Helen is saying, is that they're one of the reasons that, yes, there's been more money put towards birth control, but there's still this problem with unintended pregnancy, is that a lot of women don't use it regularly or effectively. One of the stories that I did this week was a woman who had been using it, did have insurance coverage, but found that she couldn't afford it and, in fact, got pregnant accidentally. So you have this problem. And I think what the committee said was that if women could afford perhaps the more expensive but more reliable types of birth control, that perhaps we would then reduce this problem of unintended pregnancy.
What about emergency contraceptives like Plan B or Ella?
Those would be covered because those are part of the FDA-approved package of contraception. But again, that's where you get into these issues of do they act as potential very early abortions or not. That is an argument that continues to go on.
How medically, are they supposed to work?
Well, medically they say they work. They work. We do know they work primarily by inhibiting ovulation. So if there's no ovulation, there's no fertilization, then there is no issue. There is. In theory, they can also work by preventing implantation of a fertilized egg. That is where you get into this question of is that or is that not by preventing the implantation of an abortifacient quality. Medically, it's considered not, but theologically, for many people, once that egg is fertilized, that is a human being.
But RU486 is specifically not included.
No, it is not.
Correct?
That will interrupt a pregnancy once it is established, and that is not included in this recommendation. That would not necessarily be required to be covered. That is a whole different issue.
But what about Helen's point that with government intervention in this whole birth control issue, that pregnancies, that sexual behavior, that everything has just gone up, Julie?
I've looked at some of the things that Helen has written. I'm not a sociologist, so I'm not sure I can how well I can interpret that. But I do see that I can see where the possibility of as both sides have said, you have birth control out there, but it's not, there are financial barriers to it, that perhaps people don't use it as effectively or as well as they could. As we know, there's not a lot of male birth control out there, so it's all up to the woman, or primarily all up to the woman. So I can see how what she writes is what both sides are saying can be true.
Dr. Rosenstock, talk about why the committee included all contraceptives, including Plan B and Ella.
Happy to do so. And I just want to say sometimes we can look at the same evidence and interpret it differently, but the committee overwhelmingly felt the scientific evidence was that contraceptions with counseling are very effective in reducing unintended pregnancies. End of story. It doesn't mean that in every single person, in every single case, in every single setting, but overall felt the evidence was just compellingly strong. The reason that we turned to the full array of FDA-approved medicine devices is that this is just a recommendation for HHS to consider what should have first dollar coverage, because we know not just for family planning, but for a variety of services, both preventive and otherwise, that copayments and deductibles are barriers to getting services. And in the preventive services realm, this is what we're trying to attack. And this is where you need to individualize things. We didn't want to, nor did we think we should be, prescriptive for what's the best method for an individual woman. Some women have higher risks of cardiovascular complications from traditional birth control medications, and other approaches are necessary. The emergency contraception pill, theological debate aside, is an effective part of the toolbox that is recommended as a birth control, not as a abortion-inducing agent, as a birth control device.
May I comment on the use of the language theological?
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Helen.
Just one little point there is it's not theological. When you're talking about the existence of an embryo, it's a healthcare issue. It's not a question of theology. Theology simply responds to what the facts are. And if one church teaches for or against this, it doesn't mean that one of the actions of Ella or RU486 or morning after pill is not to destroy or the possibility for an embryo to exist. Second, I just wanted to add, it's not a question of misinterpreting evidence. The evidence is clear as can be. The IOM report cherry-picked when it looked at evidence regarding the relationship between government funding or more birth control and pregnancies. They didn't grapple with any of the leading studies by serious economists, sociologists, psychologists
on
that topic.
Hold it right there. Dr. Rosenstock, do you want to respond?
I'm going to stay with the original statement. We felt we looked at all of the evidence relevant to our charge, and our charge was not to include economic issues or costs, and that is part of the reason that we said, what is the evidence that the intervention, family planning, well women visits, sexual counseling about sexually transmitted diseases, those kinds of, it was, you know, diabetes, whatever it was, our job was, is there evidence that this screening or service works to improve health? And we rest soundly that we identified the appropriate literature, and we searched broadly.
All right. Now, I want to get back to the cost. Judy Waxman, should all Americans be responsible for paying for women's contraceptives?
I think they should. The same way they should be responsible for paying for women's mammograms and pap smears and the other preventive services that are already included in the preventive benefit package and will someday include these new eight services mentioned by the committee.
Is there any indication as to, in the long run, Julie, how much money this could actually save American taxpayers in healthcare costs?
I have not seen this number quantified yet. I'm sure that we will see it at some point, but certainly the cost of. Judy, do you have the number?
Well, there was one study a few years ago, by the Washington Business Group on Health, which is a group that represents large companies, and their recommendation at the time to their businesses in their association was to cover contraception without copays. And if they didn't, the number was 15 to 17%. It will cost them 15 to 17% more if they did not cover contraceptives with no copays.
And Julie, didn't NPR and Thomson Reuters do a poll in April? What were they looking at?
Yes, we did. We asked the public whether they supported the requirement, basically, for coverage of required coverage of contraception. It was overwhelming that the public did support this. I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but
Julie Robner, she's health policy correspondent for NPR. Judy Waxman, she's at the National Women's Law Center. Helen Alvarez is professor of law at George Mason University. On the line with us, Linda Rosenstock, she's chair of the Institute of Medicine's Committee for Preventive Services for Women, the group that has made the recommendations to Secretary of Health and Human Services, Sebelius, and that decision will be coming soon.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, celebrating 20 years of being a source for what works in education. More at edutopia.org. By Plowshares Fund, dedicated to helping build a safe, secure, and nuclear weapon-free world at plowshares.org. And by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org. This is NPR.
Fox News analyst and former NPR correspondent Juan Williams, why he believes political correctness is stifling honest debate in America. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. It's time to open the phones. We go first to Indianapolis and to Valerie. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. I have a question for your guest, Helen. When she was discussing how the correlation between increased government intervention and an increase in unintended pregnancies, I was just wondering, is it possible that we're confusing correlation and causation in this case? Because not only since the 1980s, I think she thought, things have gone up. I mean, there's abstinence-only sex education. There's makes it hard for people that don't have insurance to get access to contraception. So I just wonder if it's not really the case that government intervention is why these things are going up, and that if, in fact, people did have access to things like IUDs, which my insurance, I was lucky enough that it completely covered. In fact, if we would see a decrease.
Thanks. That's a terrific question, and that's always a question when you're looking at statistics. Indeed, it's a combination of things like social customs, mores, the law, which used to penalize things in connection with sex that it no longer does. But I think if you look at, and I'll recommend a couple studies, Baumeister and Vose on sexual economics, Mark Regnerus on premarital sex in America, Akerlof, Yellen, and Katz in the Journal of Economics, I think in 1966, you'll see that they do a very convincing explanation of how it is that when sex and babies are completely dissociated, it changes the sexual market. Women feel that they have to participate or ought to, or that it's expected of them in connection with relationships. Women do. There's all kinds of reasons. I think the book Promises I Can Keep about non-marital births among the poor is the best on this. All kinds of reasons why both poor and more well-off women don't use it. And what happens is there ends up with more non-marital births, more non-marital uncommitted sexual relations, and more abortions. I think the case for causation is pretty strong if you look at the expert literature.
All right, let's go to Jimmy in Laurel, Maryland. Good morning to you.
Hi. I have no problem with covering birth control, but Barmakowski stated that there's more money going to men's health than women's. I have an HMO, and I looked through. There's also, not surprisingly, since women get pregnant, but there's a lot more money going to women. Even there's also, for instance, free breast cancer screening, despite the fact you can get it free in Montgomery County. More women have health care than men, and in fact, you say women live longer. Perhaps it's the health care is something to do with it, but I don't know where she gets the thing that more money goes to men. I pay the same price. And there's all sorts of stuff I'm paying for. I'm sure
all right.
It goes to women.
Thanks for calling.
Actually, one of the things that the law does is for the first time, you didn't used to pay the same price. Women actually for a long time paid more than men for health insurance. There's been a long history of gender discrimination. Because women have babies, women were often charged more for health insurance than men. Women also have tended to use more health care, not so much because they've needed more health care, but because men have been not very good about getting health care, which is one of the reasons probably why women live longer than men, because men have been sort of not very good about going and getting health care that they perhaps needed. Women tend to be better about getting preventive care that's called for than men. But the gender discrimination is actually no longer going to be allowed under the provisions
of this
law.
I wonder whether men's prostate cancer prevention programs might also be covered. Judy.
Yes, they are covered. The screening is covered as part of the United States Preventive Services Task Force list, as Julie mentioned at the top of the hour, is required by the Affordable Care Act before this new study came out on women's issues.
All right, and let's go to Dallas, Texas. Good morning, Ed. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
This actually turns out to be a follow-up on the first caller for Helen Alvarez, and when she talked about the outcomes from spending on birth control, she talked about how birth control therefore results in unwanted pregnancies and these other negative outcomes, and of course there's really no way to show that through a correlational study. It would also be possible that government spends more money on birth control in areas where you have high levels of unwanted pregnancies and negative outcomes. So, in fact, the presence of these negative...
Oh, dear. Phone line dropped. Sorry. Go ahead.
The phenomena that you're seeing here, as explained both in the law and economics literature, sociological and psychological, is the same phenomena you saw with things like seatbelts or drugs for AIDS. It's called risk compensation, and it's a well-accepted explanation in these fields as to people moving to riskier behavior when they believe that the risk has been shut down. It's the insurance effect, if you will. I think one of the problems I have with it is that, in part, we haven't discussed it yet, but this preventive care mandate would have no conscience protection. So all diverse voices, all voices of conscience on this, all contrary research is kind of squelched. You know, it's choked off. People don't even get to experiment with other ways to approach the question, ways that women might be very interested in, which might involve tying sex and commitment more closely, bringing the concept of that children are created by sex, making sex a pretty important thing back into vogue as well.
Judy.
This is about insurance and about coverage of items that the scientists feel are preventive health care for all women in this country. That doesn't mean we can't do other programs across the land about responsible behavior, about sex ed, which I think is really pretty lacking across the country in terms of many of the issues Helen raises and others about how to properly use birth control. But on the issue of insurance, I really think I need to go back to the science and the scientists on the panel that looked at the literature. They looked at other federal policies. They looked at what is already in existence in health plans. And they came up with this great list that I think will help women.
Here's an email from Nick in Leesburg, Virginia. Will the cost of covering contraceptives increase the cost of insurance? If not, there really is no argument against covering them for those such as Roman Catholics who cannot use them can still choose not to do so. It's not as though having a plan that mandates covering contraceptives means that people are forced to start using them. Julie.
Well, it will increase it to the extent that it will be now be built into the premium because it will be first dollar coverage. And as to your earlier question about cost, this is actually in the report. As the committee chairman said, they were not charged with looking at cost, but they actually did look at some of the studies that talked about cost. They said the direct medical cost of unintended pregnancy in the U.S. was estimated to be nearly $5 billion in 2002, with cost savings due to contraceptive use estimated to be $19.3 billion.
Yes. All right, to David in Chesapeake, Virginia. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I think everyone would agree that, you know, just in general, we want to do things to help people pay for health care and, you know, kind of better their lives. But what these polls and this data doesn't show is the fraudulent and, fraudulent activity that's going on concerning the costs. Once it's approved at a federal level, when it gets to the state and local levels, what's happening is you know, and why these contraceptives and you know, birth control type programs, why they fail is because, you know, even though the overall intention is well taken, when it gets to the state and local level, and even though these polls are, you know, asking questions and seeing, you know, looking at the habits, psychology and everything of women, a lot of the women at the, say, the social service receiver programs, you know, the welfare end of it, they aren't telling the truth as to how they are really using this money. And I think that because the welfare programs have more incentive for women to be irresponsible and have kids because they can collect more money out of that than they're really saving at the healthcare industry part of it and birth control part of it, that it really defeats its purpose. And
Judy Waxman, do you want to comment?
It's hard. I think I'm not sure what the question was exactly. But I do want to say that there is not money floating around that goes to individual people for them to buy or not buy their birth control. It's covered by their insurance or by Medicaid, which some low-income women can take advantage of. So if they need this service, they go to a health care provider and they get it. There's really no money that's going just out, and if I am responding properly to the caller's
Julie.
Question.
And the Title X program, which provides birth control, doesn't have anything to do with the welfare programs that give out money to people who have babies.
So all right.
There would be no incentive
sure.
there.
To Miami, Florida. Good morning, William.
Hi, Diane.
Hi.
I sell insurance, and I think the comment that nobody considered the cost
is a really bad thing here, and doing away with deductibles is another bad thing. My clients are small businessmen who try to help their employees with insurance. They want and they're demanding a cafeteria plan, and another mandate is going to push them over the cliff. These things cost money. Somebody has to pay. And if the idea is to wipe out the insurance market for the small businessman, that's what we're going to do, and that's my biggest concern.
How so?
First of all, this is, if we're talking about the contraceptives, most plans already cover it, and it, in fact, is mandated by federal law for most businesses. So it's not a huge cost. The difference, as we said many times, is making it first dollar coverage.
Explain what that means.
What that means is now I want to get my contraception from, and my insurance company covers it, but they'll say to me, as I mentioned to my daughter, you have to pay us $25 a month and we'll pay the rest. Now what would be, the coverage is still there. It's the same. She can get the same product, but she will not have to pay the $25 a month. So where is that $25 going to come from, you might ask? And the answer is it'll probably be spread throughout the system. Maybe drug manufacturers will get paid a little less for the product. Maybe the pharmacists won't make quite as much profit. And maybe there'll be a little addition into the health plan. But as we have said, if people get and use contraceptives, it actually saves money to the premiums and the system overall.
All right, and to Cincinnati, Ohio. Good morning, Bernard.
Good morning, Dan. I wanted to make a comment about, because my wife and I, we pay about $400 through my employer for health insurance. And when we decided for her to go to contraceptives, they said, we don't cover it. We tried everything, all of them. I know it's in a pill. They don't cover anything. So what we ended up doing is I have to pay $75 every month to get a contraceptive, which I think is unfair. So I think this, when they enact that law, it's going to help, because people don't just want to have babies. If there are means to prevent unwanted pregnancies, I think people will do it. Most people are not irresponsible just to have babies when they know they can prevent it. In this case, what should I do? I mean, should I let my employer go away, you know, my insurance company go away like that? Or is there a way that I can let them cover for that?
All right, Bernard, thanks for calling. Just to remind, you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Julie.
Indeed, as we point out, most employers do cover contraceptives, but not all of them. And under this, this would be a requirement, but not for grandfathered plans, as we say. So
oh,
it would only
I
be
see.
As plans change, they would have to then.
What
start
about the
this.
IUD? Would that be covered?
Yes, it would. It is the requirements for all FDA approved contraceptive devices.
All right, and finally to Stacy in Fort Lauderdale. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi, Diane. Here's what I have to say. You know, I live here in Florida, and we have a very high unemployment rate. We have a lot of problems. The first thing our Republican supermajority legislature did when they got in under Rick Scott, our new governor, is to pass a whole host of anti-choice, anti-women's health, really, abortion rules and regulations. So, you know, what I'm trying to say here is that I think when it comes to anything at all, and I'm vehemently pro-choice, but if there's anything that smacks of abortion, science is going to be trumped by the chokehold that a very vocal minority have in this country. You know, and yes, it is, when you do polls, it is in how you ask a question, how you pose a question. The majority of Americans do believe that a woman should have the right to, you know, reproductive freedoms and control over her reproductive biology. But we have people who are just so far to the right against it, and they have been voted into office. So what I'm saying is I hope that this science is going to be recognized, the scientists who actually came up with this, because it looks like religion once again is going to trump it.
All right. Thanks for calling, Helen.
Well, I think it's actually the other way around here. The This report does not contain, I mean, my entire specialty is looking at the relationship between what the law has done on particular issues and their impact on the family. Nobody has controverted this evidence that because of these, the change in the market for sex mating and marriage, you have worse problems for women, not better. The market is already saturating them with contraception. The report here, rather than religion choking off science, had science cherry-picking studies to lead to its conclusion, choking off other possible ideas, particularly ideas that might help poor and immigrant women who are suffering the most at this time.
One final question for you, Helen. This comes from Erin in Springfield, Missouri. Do you believe in birth control at all?
To me, my specialty and the only thing I've brought to the table today, and I assume others did too, is what we know about the relationship between what the law does here in defining preventive care and what the conclusion is. And I guess if everybody here wanted to have a conversation about philosophical or theological beliefs, we could do that too.
But do you believe in birth control?
I think that is a way of dodging my evidence, and I would rather someone ask a question about the evidence I've brought to the table today.
All right. Thanks very much for that answer. Helen Alvarez, professor of law at George Mason University, Julie Robner of NPR, Judy Waxman of the National Women's Law Center. You heard earlier from Dr. Linda Rosenstock of the Institute of Medicine and Senator Barbara Mikulski. Thank you all so much. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.